Ned Jacob on behalf of Andres Castillo. I want to begin with a very elementary proposition, an axiomatic one, that the jury's job in a criminal trial is to find the facts and apply the law it has been given to those facts and to reach a verdict. But the jury can't reliably do that job. They can't apply the law to the facts if they're given irrelevant instructions, instructions that are not supported by the evidence, that erroneously limit its evaluation of the central issue in the case. The central issue in this case, the only issue, is whether or not Mr. Castillo acted reasonably in self-defense. The reason that that impairs the jury in being able to do its job is because it's possible, as the Colorado Supreme Court said in Kaufman, it's possible the jury may have wondered why it was given these instructions, may have decided that it must have been for some purpose, and then forced the evidence to fit those instructions, thereby limiting a claim, in this case, like in Kaufman, of self-defense.
Let me ask you, counsel, did the prosecution argue initial aggressor and provocation in their closing arguments?
Yes, both in their opening closing argument and in their rebuttal closing argument. I believe the prosecutor stated at least twice, "You bet he's the initial aggressor," and several, stated that self-defense doesn't apply if he's the initial aggressor. Additionally, and I think I covered this in the brief, he or she also argued provocation in kind of a sort of backhanded way. If you don't believe that he provoked the shots by this unknown handgun shooter when he racked his shot or when he strode into the crowd, et cetera, which, by the way, there's no evidence of. So this, interjecting this, these issues in the case impairs the jury to the reliability of the jury's verdict, the ability of the jury to reach a verdict.
Why isn't it equally plausible that if the jury determines there was no basis for, let's say, the initial aggressor, that they just disregard the instruction? Isn't that more consistent with our normal rule that we presume the jury follows the court's instructions?
Well, I think there are several problems with that proposition in this case, and that would go, I mean, I think, Judge Berger, what you're suggesting is that would go to whether or not the error was harmless or
right.
not. First off, the standard here, I would submit, is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't think beyond a reasonable doubt that this court can conclude that interjecting these issues into the case are harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Contrast it, for example, with Manzanares, where the error was found to be harmless, but that was because the prosecutor didn't argue that the defendant was the initial aggressor. That was because the jury found, I believe, or did not find that he intended to cause serious bodily injury or something like that. You know, contrast that with Beasley, contrast that with Silva.
Mr. Jekyll, does our decision in this case turn on whether there was one altercation or two?
Does it turn on that? No, I don't believe it does. I don't believe it does with respect to either of those instructions. However, I would submit that there is one altercation in this case. This is like Beasley. This is a continuous, uninterrupted action. And if you look at the witness's testimony, we're talking about seconds here. This entire transaction takes a matter of seconds from start to finish. As little as 7 seconds by one witness's account, and under 60 seconds by every single witness's account, around 20 seconds here.
What distance was there between the defendant and the police officers who were firing at him?
And I don't know if there's conflicting testimony on that, but I believe it was less than 15 feet, I think. I think I read some testimony last night. It was about 15 feet or
something like
that.
That's about from me to you. Does that make
sense? Pretty darn close, yeah.
And what was the lighting condition?
There was conflicting testimony about that. It's nighttime, of course. There's some lighting in the area. I think one of the officers described it as fair or something like that. Not, you know, right, not him.
How many shots did he take at the police officers?
One, possibly two. I think two.
Is there any different rule when police officers are shooting at you as far as, you know, self-defense?
No, you're entitled to exercise self-defense against police officers as well. I think, though, it's not so much their status as police officers that makes much difference in this case, because the jury clearly rejected that he knew they were police officers.
That may be so as far as rejecting it, but as far as giving instruction, if there was an inference from which the jury could have found that they were police officers, then they might have been entitled to have considered an instruction. I think your answer is, though, is there's no special rule for police officers.
That is the correct answer. That is my answer as well, Judge. And unfortunately, I don't have it at my fingertips, but there's a case also to support that. I might even cite it in a case that you sat on once, but, you know, years ago. So the facts here are really largely undisputed, and they take place in a matter of seconds, really. Which are these, that an unknown person opens fire with a handgun toward Mr. Castillo and his family. Mr. Castillo gets a shotgun out of his trunk, returns fire. Police Sergeant Lombardi, the officer in charge, 21-year veteran, he didn't hear the initial handgun fire, but the shotgun is boom, it's a loud noise, and he's running toward Mr. Castillo. Simmons gets out of his car, follows him. These are ultimately the two named victims in the case. Sergeant Lombardi testifies in no uncertain terms that he's got his gun out and that he doesn't announce and that he shoots twice before Mr. Castillo shoots. I just want to talk about that testimony because it's so clear and unequivocal. You fired at Mr. Castillo first. Answer, yes, sir. In fact, Mr. Castillo, you shot at Mr. Castillo twice before he fired at you. Answer, yes. Question, Mr. Castillo didn't have his shotgun pointed at you when you fired at him. Answer, the first time, no. He didn't have the shotgun pointed at you the second time you fired, two times in succession. Answer, yes, sir. And Mr. Castillo didn't have the shotgun pointed at you when you fired those two successive shots. No. Further testifies that he is the first police officer who fired Mr. Castillo. Simmons is trailing him. Simmons, I don't think his testimony is even inconsistent with Sergeant Lombardi's testimony. So either whether you look at as a Beasley situation and you look at the initial aggressor from the, you know, as being the handgun shooter and in a continuous fight, and so Mr. Castillo can't be the initial aggressor.
Well, let me ask you about the original shooter. Could he have been the initial aggressor against the original shooter? Wasn't there at least one witness who indicated that they hadn't heard shots until he had exited the car and popped the trunk on the car?
That is correct. There's a conflict about that. There was one witness,
right,
who testified to that. She also said that the shots were immediate upon him getting out of the car.
Now, getting out of the car?
The trunk.
Okay. Because I was just going to ask you, is getting out of the car and popping the trunk, could that be perceived as being physically threatening?
No, not as to initial aggressor. Right. Certainly not as to provocation. It certainly doesn't indicate an intent to try to provoke a violent response.
Mr. Jekyll, is there anything in the record about what was said by either the handgun shooter or the defendant in that initial encounter that they had before the shooting started?
Sure. Let me back up just one thing. I don't even think it's clear from the record that the initial encounter is with the person who ultimately fires the handgun. All we know is that they're both African-American males. Whether it's the same guy or not, I don't know. And we don't know from this record. But as to answer your question, Judge Berger, there is no evidence. There is, it's described as talking stuff initiated by the African-American male who's the passerby.
So I take it your position would be that there would be plainly insufficient evidence from that for a jury to infer initial aggression by the defendant.
Or provocation, correct. So And let me further address provocation, because I think this case is the Silva case in every way that matters. There's an argument, as we just discussed, that nobody can recall the content of. In Silva, they didn't. There was no evidence as to who spoke first. Here, we know who spoke first, that this passerby speaks first. All we know is they spoke stuff to each other, as how it's described, and then someone opens fire on Mr. Castillo. Again, we don't know if it's the same guy or a different guy, but there's a guy shooting a handgun towards Mr. Castillo, his wife, his cousin, occupants of his vehicle. So, like in Silva, the two named victims, Sergeant Lombardi, Officer Simmons, they're not even present when that exchange happens. They're not present when this gunfight begins. So not only is there no evidence to support provocation of this passerby, there's surely no evidence to support provocation with respect to these two police officers. And I would submit that the same goes for initial aggressor for the reasons that we stated. First off, under Beasley, that it's a continuous, uninterrupted fight lasting seconds, not minutes. And that Mr. Castillo's testimony is, as far as he knows, these are additional assailants shooting at him from his right. He reacts instinctually, shoots towards them. The problem here is, of course, exacerbated by the prosecutor's closing argument, where he relies on an initial aggressor and relies on it in what I would submit is a somewhat misleading way of saying, you can't claim self-defense if you started it. Obviously, these terms, initial aggressor, provocation, they have very precise statutory meanings. They don't mean if you started it. And he says that, he or she says that several times, two, possibly three times during the closing argument. They ignore the fact that the handgun shooter has started first. They even suggest that Mr. Castillo, even in the face of this unequivocal testimony by Sergeant Lombardi, they imply that Mr. Castillo shot at the officers before they shot at him. So even if you parse it out into two different fights, which I don't think you can under Beasley, I don't think you should, I don't think that's the way to view a gunfight that occurs in this length of time, but even if you do parse it out, he is not the initial aggressor vis-a-vis the police officers as well. If the court has no further questions, I reserve remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. The jury is well equipped to analyze the evidence. That's what both the United States Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court have held. Because the jury is well equipped to analyze the evidence, courts should presume that the jury relied on the instructions supported by the evidence and not presume that the jury was misled by instructions that were not supported by the evidence.
In what case says that?
That's in Dunaway, and is the Colorado Supreme Court case, and Griffin is the United States Supreme Court case.
But how do you score that with Kaufman? Kaufman's a later case and seems to say otherwise.
I would say that Kaufman is entirely consistent with Dunaway. Dunaway recognized the distinction between instructions that incorrectly state the law and instructions that properly state the law but are not implicated by the evidence. In Kaufman, it addressed both kinds of errors in the self-defense instructions in that case. The court first considered a legally incorrect instruction regarding when self-defense applies, and it found that that legally incorrect instruction was prejudicial and required reversal. Solely to provide guidance for retrial, the court also considered a legally correct instruction on combat by agreement, an exception like the exceptions we have here for initial aggressors and provocation, and noted that it was not supported by the evidence, and then made the unremarkable observation that it should not have been given. But the court expressly did not address whether that error would require reversal. It expressly said it was not considering whether it would be harmless or whether it was prejudicial. The court also noted the possibility that giving an instruction unsupported by the evidence could confuse the jury. But Dunaway and Griffin also recognized that possibility. It's indisputably a possibility.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel, because Dunaway has to do with an alternative or an alternative to an element that's not supported by the evidence. Is that correct?
An alternative, yes.
Okay.
An alternative theory of liability. Not
what would happen if, in the case of that you're positing, the prosecutor argued to the jury that there was evidence of that alternative element for which there was no evidence? Would that be in a circumstance that would demonstrate harm?
I don't think so. And I think it ultimately comes back to the basic principle that these cases, Griffin and Dunaway, enunciate and are relying on, which is that the jury is well-equipped to analyze the evidence.
The jury is well-equipped to analyze the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They're having an advocate argue, despite the lack of evidence, that there is a basis upon which they can return a guilty verdict. That's not going to be harmful?
I guess, and maybe this is just to parse it a little finer, there are two different ways I can see that the prosecution could argue. The prosecution could argue, I think that you can infer these facts from the evidence, and I think these are reasonable inferences, and under the law, these would constitute the offense.
I
think that's what happened in this case. But
what is the evidence that will support a reasonable finding that he was the initial aggressor?
I think I outlined that in the answer brief. There were many witnesses in this case, 23 witnesses. Many of them were eyewitnesses, and they gave accounts that could not all be reconciled with each other. There definitely is plenty of evidence supporting that he wasn't the initial aggressor, but I think there is enough in there that he was an initial aggressor that it could have been something that the...
But the trial court's reliance was solely on his racking of the shotgun, as I recall. That was the basis for the trial court's decision to give the instruction. Was there anything besides that you can point us to that would constitute evidence of initial aggression?
Well, I think that the evidence of initial aggression includes the witness's testimony that the defendant got out of the car, popped the trunk before he ever... before there were any shots fired, as well as this initial interaction between him and the person who could have been the shooter, and especially his own testimony about what happened during that event, that the jury was able to directly assess his credibility about that issue and decide what it thought that he had said during that interaction.
But how would just popping the trunk support an inference that there was initial aggression by the defendant?
I think the jury could have concluded, if it disbelieved the defendant's testimony, that he had not threatened the shooter with a weapon, that he had threatened the shooter with a weapon. He'd said, I'm going to shoot you, and then popped the trunk and got out of the car.
Counsel, this is an interesting argument to make, that, you know, the lack of evidence becomes... you know, the provision of evidence because someone denied the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't often help you, or it wouldn't help you if this were a principle that were adopted, say, for when a defendant asks for a lesser offense instruction.
Mm-hmm.
We normally say you've got to have affirmative evidence at that point. If this principle were to apply evenly
mm-hmm.
to here and to that situation, they'd be entitled to lesser offenses all the time because there'd be an evidentiary basis. Someone denied it. Is that what you're advocating?
I'm presenting the case law that we have in this jurisdiction and from the United States Supreme Court about this issue.
You're presenting that case law. You're asking us to buy it. Are you advocating we buy it across the board?
Yes. And if I could discuss the issue further, though, I think maybe that I can further explain sort of the distinction I think I see between these cases that I've cited and maybe what they're getting at in these other cases that the defendant has cited. And that is that... when a defendant, let's take the example that is cited in, that is the example given in one of the cases that the defendant cited, which is that a witness testifies that it wasn't raining in a particular place at a particular time. And I think I would agree that in isolation, that piece of information, even if you disbelieve it, doesn't establish that it was raining, because there are multiple alternative explanations for why that person may not have been there, They may not have been paying attention. They may have had their memory deteriorate over time. So you have to take into account also the context. As we gain additional information about it, say that we also have testimony that they do believe that they were there at the time, that they did recall other events that were around there, that they had a reason to pay attention to this, that they have a motive to be fabricating this to say the opposite of what it is, even if it was.
So the prosecution, can meet its burden of proof by putting on a witness who testifies exactly contrary to every element of a crime. Prosecution can turn to the jury and say, from that testimony, you can believe the exact opposite and convict a defendant of a crime. Is that your position?
Maybe. I guess it depend on how much of this are surrounding circumstances. I think that this is a factor. It's a piece of circumstantial evidence which goes in along with the other evidence, which together can build a case. And I think that's what the United States Supreme Court and this one vision, the Court of Appeals, have found, is that the that this can be affirmative evidence of guilt if you disbelieve what the defendant's testimony is.
Well, not only the defendant's testimony, let's put witness X on.
Sorry.
Were you there that day? Yes. Did you see the defendant shoot this person? No. Ah, there's evidence he shot that person.
That, I would say, would not be enough.
Why?
Because we don't have, we need more information about, well, did they have a reason to pay attention? Do they have any motives about this? Is their memory deteriorated over time? There are other possible explanations here. And it's after we get enough circumstances around that, that then you can reach that conclusion. Is that?
Mr. Swanson, I'm having a difficult time with the Supreme Court's language in Kaufman, where they say, during deliberations, it is possible that the jury may have wondered why it was given the instruction, decided that it must have been for some purpose, and forced the evidence to fit the instruction, thereby denying Kaufman his claim to self-defense. That sounds like error analysis to me, not merely the question of whether or not it was erroneous to give the instruction. And since Kaufman was decided after the other case you cited, I just don't understand how we're not bound to apply that rationale and that logic.
Well, first I would say that Kaufman directly says, we do not address whether the error in providing the mutual combat instruction was sufficiently prejudicial to require reversal under the harmless error standard. That's directly what it says. The other thing I'd say is that it recognizes that possibility, and Dunaway also recognizes that possibility. It is indisputably a possibility. What Dunaway and what Griffin hold is that it is a remote possibility, that it's not a significant enough possibility to warrant reversal. And I think a remote possibility is not a significant enough possibility or probability of prejudice to require reversal under any standard here.
When the prosecution relies on the part of the instruction that is claimed to be erroneous, isn't that a little bit different factor, different circumstance than, say, the Dunaway circumstance?
And I think that gets back to what I was trying to say earlier, is if the prosecution says, here is a set of facts that I think you can find, and they constitute whatever the instruction at issue is, which I think is what happened in this case. If they're correct legally, that those facts would constitute this, then I think the jury is well positioned to say, you know, that you may be right, but those facts just aren't the facts.
Well,
of this
if
case.
They're correct, there wouldn't have been an error in the jury instruction, would there?
That's right.
If the prosecution had that evidence that would have supported that part of the jury instruction, it wouldn't have been error to give that part of the jury instruction.
That's right.
They wouldn't have been misled because that would have been a legitimate consideration.
So I'm saying if the prosecution is incorrect, they're arguing an unreasonable inference, then the jury will reject it. Now, let's say, to take just as the counter hypothetical, is what if the prosecution gets up there and they argue that these facts, which are supported by the evidence, constitute this issue, make them an initial aggressor, and they're wrong legally, that those facts don't meet the legal definition for initial aggressor. They're saying these facts in this case you know, you can find these facts, and you can find those facts, and they're wrong that those meet the exception of initial aggressor, I would say that then becomes a problem. Does that distinction make sense? At least I'm trying to say it depends on whether what the prosecutor is saying is a legal error or a factual error. If it's a factual determination, they're saying, I believe you can refine these facts, and they can't find those facts, then the jury's well-equipped to analyze the evidence itself and come to the conclusion, no, I can't find those facts. And if it's that kind of error, because that's within the realm of what the jury is good at, what our whole system is presumed on them being able to accurately do, then that error would not be prejudicial. And I would say in this case, it's correct that the prosecution argued provocation and initial aggressors. But what they did is they said, and it did very clearly, it was, I think you can infer these facts. I think you can infer that he said something to the defendant to threaten him with a weapon and got out of the car and threatened him with a shotgun. And then he even expressly said, if you don't find those facts, then he's not the initial aggressor.
What evidence was there that he threatened him before he got out of the car?
They had a conversation with another individual. There was testimony that he was cussing, and that they were both cussing at each other. And then we have his testimony about what he said. He said he didn't really remember, but he said he didn't do these things. And I think there's certain sufficient circumstantial evidence around that to indicate that if the jury disbelieved him, they weren't required to disbelieve him, that was an issue for the jury, but if they disbelieved him, they could have also reached the additional conclusion that he had, in fact, threatened him with a weapon at that time.
Mr. Swanson, before your time is up, can you explain to me how a lay juror would have known that in making their determinations as to whether any of these exceptions to self-defense existed, they would know to apply the beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
I think that is adequately conveyed by the instructions that were given. The jury was instructed that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted without the affirmative defense. And then it was told that the acts without the affirmative defense if these things exist. And I think that the follows from that they were informed that the prosecution had to prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. And this was also discussed during closing arguments and not disputed that was what the burden was on the prosecution.
What would have been the harm giving the defendant's instruction that made it explicit that you should not reject self-defense on the grounds of initial aggression unless you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the initial aggressor? I just didn't understand why the court didn't make that crystal clear.
I mean, I think the harm is just in the sense of they'd already gone through instructions so numerous times. I'm not totally clear, had them printed out at this point. And it's just a matter of, you could always just put in another instruction and another instruction and another instruction to make things more and more clear. And it's just within the court's discretion to decide when it's going to draw the line. And whenever it makes those line drawings, it's going to be hard to say on one side or the other whether would have been prejudicial or would have been harmful. But I mean, there's obviously some point at which you just repeating a thing over and over and over again just becomes a waste of time or becomes confusing and redundant and just unnecessary. And this is where the court decided to draw the line in this case. And I think that was within the discretion. And I see my time is up, so I ask the court to affirm the judgment of conviction.
Thank you.
Very briefly, let me turn to the last point that Judge Berger made. I think that is also a problem. I know I didn't talk on my opening argument about the problem of declining that instruction, but that is also a problem. And it ties in with the prosecutor's argument, who invited the jury to say that self-defense doesn't apply if he's the initial aggressor or if he's a provocateur. That's exactly how the instruction reads, and it reads differently than the Colgi instruction. Interestingly enough, it says it is not an affirmative defense to and then if initial aggressor, if provocation. So I think that exacerbates the problem here, again, on the central issue of this case. Maybe I don't have a nuanced enough mind to understand how Dunaway factors into this case. I don't think it does at all. The prosecution has the burden to establish initial aggressor. They have the burden to establish provocation. Granted, the evidence viewed in the light most favorable of those instructions, in order to get that instruction in the first place. Therefore, in my mind, the giving of those instructions is a legal error, notwithstanding anything in Dunaway. Mr. Castillo was entitled to act on appearances as they appeared to him from his standpoint, as they reasonably appeared to him. And I would ask this court to have a jury that's properly instructed to evaluate the reasonableness of Mr. Castillo's actions at a new trial. And if the court has no further questions, I'd ask the court to reverse his convictions.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.